Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not a hard thing to figure out. If you don't have the money, you can't spend it. Unless, that is, you're an American consumer. We had confirmation again today that this country doesn't believe a penny saved is a penny earned. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fellows. Millions of businesses worldwide choose Fellow Shredders for their shredding needs. Fellows, the bulldog of shredders. More at Fellows.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be here on this first day of February. It's a Thursday today, 2007, by the way. But the news of the day comes to us from the way back machine, 1933. The personal savings rate the year Franklin Roosevelt moved into the White House was -1.5% of disposable income. Makes sense that people were dipping into their savings when you remember the Great Depression was in full swing. 73 years later, the economy's a whole lot better, but we've gone back to our spending ways. The Commerce Department told us this morning that last year, the savings rate hit its lowest level since the early 1930s. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Last year, Americans saved -1% of their disposable income, which means they spent everything they earned and then dipped into savings or borrowed to spend more. It's one of the great quandaries of the consumer economy. Spending fuels growth and creates jobs. But Standard & Poor's economist David Weiss says this kind of spending just can't last.
I don't know what people expect to do. They're just not thinking very much about tomorrow.
The picture may not be as dire as it sounds. During the Depression, Americans weren't saving because a quarter of the labor force was out of work. But today they have more ways of building wealth. Carl Steitman is chief economist with Deloitte Research. He says the savings rate doesn't include money made on the stock market or from the sale of a home.
What we've seen over the last decade or so is a pretty significant accumulation of wealth on the part of households, both through the stock market as well as through housing. And in a sense, consumers are letting their houses do their savings for them.
But analysts say the recent boom can't last forever. Plenty of people don't invest in the stock market or own homes. And it is possible to save money and still watch the economy grow. In China, one of the world's fastest growing economies, the personal savings rate is an estimated 30%. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
That savings figure comes wrapped up in a more complicated economic report that was out this morning. It's called Personal Income and Outlays, how much we're making and how much we're spending. It's one of those reports that's on the A-list because consumers drive about 70% of the economy. And as you might have figured from the negative savings number, outlays were up a healthy 0.7% last month. Millions of Americans have taken advantage of the Family and Medical Leave Act, but millions more haven't. It's time off to take care of a family member, but without pay. Today, Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd announced he'll introduce a bill to expand the law that he first steered through Congress nearly 14 years ago. From the Marketplace Work and Family Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Right now, federal law gives American workers 12 weeks unpaid leave to have a baby or care for a sick child or other family member. But many can't afford to lose a paycheck for 3 months. That's why Dodd is proposing 6 weeks of partial paid leave. Dodd and the National Partnership for Women and Families have tried to expand family leave before and failed. This time, however, the Democrats are in power. Deborah Ness is president of the partnership.
It's a bill that is likely to have some real legs, and I think we are in a climate when members of Congress are very anxious to support working families.
Dodd's effort comes amid worries the Bush administration may try to water down the family leave law. The Labor Department recently requested public comments on the act and how it's working. Business groups have long complained the law is easily abused and hurts productivity. But researchers at Harvard and McGill universities released a study today showing the U.S. is the worst of all affluent countries when it comes to family leave. Jody Hyman co-wrote the study.
What the top business leaders rank as the most competitive economies, all of them but the United States provide all these benefits.
The McGill-Harvard study surveyed 173 countries. 168 guaranteed some sort of paid time off for new mothers. The five that didn't, Papua New Guinea, Lesotho, Swaziland, Liberia, and the United States. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You've heard the pharmaceutical industry joke about the costs of getting new drugs to market, right? The first pill costs $500 million to make. Everything after that's pure profit. Part of the cost is developing drugs that never get approved. Researchers in Boston said today they've figured out a way to get around that problem. Helen Palmer has more now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH.
I tell you, this sounds like the drug industry's dream.
This is a model that can predict accurately which early development drugs will be safe, effective, and profitable.
Asher Schacht is a doctor and informatics expert at Boston's Children's Hospital. He uses a complicated computer probability tool called a Bayesian network model. He feeds in lots of clinical trial data from both successful and failed drugs. Hey presto, Schacht says he can indeed predict future triumphs or disasters. That knowledge could help a pharmaceutical company cut its losses on a drug doomed to fail.
However, that drug has also had tremendous time and money invested into it, and that investment would be lost if we didn't learn from that information.
So that failure could help the company design a better drug. Schacht says it's vital drug companies share all their trial information. That would make Rodney Hayward happy. He's a professor of public health at the University of Michigan. He says that currently drug companies tend to bury their failures and hate to share trial data.
What is different, though, about this is that although there's still risk to the company in terms of sharing information and finding bad things, it's before they put in most of the money into the drug.
And on the subject of money, Schacht says they also did some cost modeling of this new approach.
We could reduce drug development costs by $283 million per approved drug.
Not only did they cut development cost, the model actually managed to increase a drug's profitability by $160 million. So the next question is, what are the odds of the drug companies buying into this model? In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
We got the year's first look at auto sales today, and they looked a whole lot like what we've been seeing for a while now. Ford and General Motors both reported double-digit percentage drops. Chrysler edged up just a hair, less than 1%. But figure this one out if you can. Shares in all three of those companies finished up today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Afghan army got a boost today thanks to the Pentagon. American forces in Kabul handed over about 800 trucks and 12,000 weapons. Allied troops are getting ready for what's expected to be a spring offensive by the Taliban. President Bush has asked for $10.5 billion to prepare. Most of that money would be for security. But a couple of billion would go to rebuilding roads and laying power lines. Afghans would probably welcome any relief. In the 5 years since the Taliban was driven out of power, lives haven't improved all that much. Some say their quality of life has actually gone down. We sent Miranda Kennedy to Kabul to find out more.
Ahmed Esmeray heads out on his morning trip to the market. He works as a cook in this upscale Kabul neighborhood, and he's been shopping here for years. It's a cluster of small shops on an unpaved street, crowded with cars and bicycles and donkeys and lots of people. Many more people than there used to be. Since the fall of the Taliban in 2001, millions of refugees have returned to Afghanistan. Kabul's population has swelled from 700,000 under the Taliban to almost 4 million today. Esmeray complains that's inflated the price of everything.
Before, there's not this crowd of people, but right now, everything we can find, but the price is a little bit higher, 10% something, 20% something, more than 20%.
You have any other shopping to do?
Some meat, mutton, and chicken.
So we're going to the butcher shop next?
Yes.
The butcher shop is just an open-air stall where fly-covered cow and sheep carcasses dangle from ceiling hooks. The butcher chops away at a side of sheep and informs Esmeray that the price has gone up for the second time in a month to $2 a pound. It was 50 cents a pound during the Taliban years. When Esmeray buys for himself, he buys the cheapest cut, sheep tails, for stew. Right now, he buys 4 pounds of mutton steaks for his boss.
Are you finished?
Yeah, I'm finished.
Back at home, Esmeray hands over the groceries to Nasir Shansab, his boss. He's one of thousands of returning Afghans and U.S. Army and U.N. personnel who are driving up the price of everything in Kabul. Shansab pays Esmeray $160 a month. That's 80% more than he earned as a cook during the Taliban era. But it's still not enough to keep up with Afghanistan's inflation, which shot up to as high as 24% after the end of the Taliban regime.
For some people in Kabul who live on a fixed income, I think it has deteriorated because of all the money that has come in. People like me who have come in and spent money, the prices have gone up, the rent has gone up, food has gone up, everything has gone up.
Shansab left Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded 30 years ago and moved to Northern Virginia. He ran a real estate business and raised a family. But the vision of a new, peaceful and democratic Afghanistan inspired him to leave it all and come back to Kabul. He got contracts with the U.S. government here to build power plants. 4 years on, he's made money, but he's lost hope in the vision.
There are things that have happened that didn't exist 4 years ago. We have a phone. There are about 2,000 kilometers of new roads. Beside that, nothing has happened. Kabul is as destroyed as it was.
Shansab says the buildings are still rubble, the country is still caught in the grip of corruption, and education and jobs elude most Afghans. The sum of all this is desperation and frustration, which Shansab says are the stepping stones to the insurgency.
They read the papers, they hear of billions of dollars coming to Afghanistan, but they don't see in their own lives any changes. You know, for an Afghan to take a gun and go to the mountains is very easy because he has nothing. He has no running water, he has no electricity, his children don't go to school. And that is something that the United States, Washington, has to take into account.
If the U.S.-led coalition forces can't provide security and basic amenities, Shansab worries Afghanistan will end up in another civil war. He's not sticking around to see what happens. He's closing out his contracts, looking for a new job for Esmeray, and then buying a one-way ticket back to the suburban comforts of Oak Hill, Virginia. In Kabul, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
I bet if I asked you what the following people have in common, you'd come up with the answer pretty quickly. Here you go. Peggy Fleming, Dorothy Hamill, and Michelle Kwan. Right, famous American figure skaters. Now try this one. Kimmy Meisner. If you're drawing a blank, join the club. Figure skaters aren't such a hot property anymore. Not even the brand new U.S. champion, Kimmy Meisner. What was once television gold has moved down the podium a bit, and our business of sports analyst Diana Nyad's got the figure skating news. Hey, Diana.
Kai, what's going on?
Well, I have a confession to make.
What?
I'm a sports fan, and I didn't even know that figure skating was this past weekend.
But do you usually watch figure skating?
I do. I mean,
you do.
I like to watch it, and I especially like to watch the women just because it's graceful and nice to watch and all that stuff. But it's a little embarrassing to say I read in the papers Sunday morning that Kimmy Meisner had won.
Yeah. This used to be one of the, you know, we call it the jewels
right.
of American sports anyway. And the U.S. championships were in Spokane, Washington
right.
last week. And I'm, you know, not to denigrate Spokane, great city.
Lovely
but
town,
it's,
right?
It's a mid-sized city. Usually the U.S. figure skating championships are taking place, you know, in Madison Square Garden because they have a huge, huge, you know, crowd
yeah.
coming in. And to be fair, they set attendance records in Spokane. That town went crazy. They loved having the championships there.
But nobody's watching on the tube. And if nobody watches on the tube, then there's not a whole lot of money.
Yeah. The numbers were way down. I mean, if you take the numbers from the Torino Olympics, where exactly a year ago now,
right.
and that's usually, you know, it's the star. It's what sets the advertising rates for the Olympics, the ladies' long program, especially that event. Well, the ratings were down by 50% in Torino from the previous Olympic Games, Salt Lake City.
Right.
Now, we just come forward 1 year, they're down another 50%. And, you know, advertisers are looking out there saying, it's not only the numbers that are down, but what's the pocket of people watching?
Let me ask you about something we were talking about just before we turned the microphones
yeah.
on, and that is the audience for figure skating. Skews older,
skews female.
70% women.
And one would think that they've got more disposable income than some 24-year-old guy who the only thing he wants to watch is the X Games.
You know, Guy, I've got to sit down with a Madison Avenue guru and say, you know, come on, don't tell me that women my age, after working, you know, all these years, don't have more disposable income mm-hmm. and don't have more power in the retail marketplace than, as you say, a post-college 24-year-old boy. Right. I just don't believe it.
You know, networks charge advertisers based on how many people are watching these games. So obviously companies aren't willing to pony up now either.
No, it's plummeting. ESPN has the first right to refusal. In a couple of months, U.S. figure skating will negotiate with them. Well, guess what? There isn't going to be a negotiation. ESPN wants the X Games and wants those young guys' sports. Mm. And so they don't even want to pay the rights fees, about $12 million a year on the last deal. So they may say to figure skating, you know what? We'll cover you. We'll put it on the air. Maybe we'll draw a few people. That's fine. But we're not going to pay any rights fees.
So how much of this is U.S. figure skating's fault for not marketing itself the right way?
Well, I think one big thing they did wrong in marketing was they put on a bunch of made-for-TV events. I know when I travel, I get into a hotel room. Whether it's mid-afternoon, late at night, I turn on for the last few years, figure skating, figure skating, right. figure skating. Most of it is Skate America, Skate with the Stars. And it doesn't mean that that's not beautiful, but that's not sport and competition. We don't care who wins. We don't care who falls. You know, so, you know, the Olympics coming every 2 years, to staggering them, you know, it used to be every 4 years, and then was a build up, who's going to win, and we'd sit on the edge of our seat, who's going to make that triple axel. Well, now it's like every 2 years, it's almost like we got oversaturated, I think, with figure skating.
Seems to me, though, that the Winter Olympics have just become more crowded. I mean, you've got snowboarding and extreme snowboarding and all these other, not quite alternative sports, but skewing younger sports that I would guess take attention away from some of the more mainline.
They have not only taken attention away, they've obliterated the attention, honestly. It used to be, I mean, always, if you look through the years, who was the star of every Winter Olympic Games? Who wound up on the cover of the Wheaties box? Right. It was Peggy Fleming. It was Dorothy Hamill. And now, who came out of Torino? What's the name, remember? Sean White, the flying tomato.
The redheaded kid.
Yeah, and he's great, but he ain't no figure skater.
All right, well, Vancouver 2010, I guess. Diana and I, thank you, Diana.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up, the football field that doubles as a TV.
Plays the same, looks the same, is the same durability. The difference is shooting up through the middle of that straw is light.
But first, let's do the numbers. We told you up at the top of the program, American consumers are generally spending more and saving less than zero. That didn't seem to bother the stock market, though. The Dow Industrials gained 0.4%, or 51 points, to close at 12,673. The NASDAQ rose nearly 0.2%, 4 points, to wrap trading at 2,468. The S&P 500 climbed better than 0.5%, about 7 points, closing at 1,445. As I mentioned, car makers dodged a bullet today. Ford up 1.9%, GM up about 0.5%, Daimler Chrysler up about 1% on the nose. ExxonMobil's earnings for 2006 added up to the highest annual profit in U.S. corporate history, more than $39 billion. Shrinking gasoline profits brought earnings down in the fourth quarter, though. Investors stayed focused on the dollar sign. Shares in the world's biggest oil company rose 1.3%. Bond prices were lower, sending the yield on the 10-year T-note higher, up to 4.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for the month of January. Presidential hopefuls get a word in at the Democratic National Committee winter meeting. And the burning question of whether or not we'll suffer six more weeks of winter is answered when we watch an animal stumble out of a hole in search of its shadow. Tomorrow is, of course, Groundhog Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Whether you're for the Colts or for the Bears, or whether you don't much care either way, the football season will be over on Sunday. Players will get much of the attention during the Super Bowl, but it's the men on the sidelines who've been in the spotlight this week. Commentator Dwayne Ballen says the arrival of two black coaches on the NFL's biggest stage could have big implications.
Will Tony Dungy and Lovie Smith indirectly help more black men gain opportunities to run major corporations? Stay with me on this. Football holds a special romantic place in the American psyche, in particular, that of the male, in particular, that of the white male. White males, for the most part, just happen to be the people that make the decisions on who sits in corporate boardrooms and at the head of companies. Football coaches hold a revered status within this subgroup. The names of the legendary ones have taken on mythic standing: Lombardi, Rockne, Bryant, Hallis. They are viewed on the same level as great business and military leaders. The metaphors flow so easily, leading the troops into battle. They're often referred to as field generals by a gushing media. They're believed to possess a special set of qualities: visionary leadership, the ability to inspire others to greatness, a determination to succeed regardless the odds, traits usually found in successful CEOs. If white males view Dungy and Smith through this prism, perhaps that will transfer to the corporate sector. Certainly, if these men can successfully navigate an NFL team to the highest level, there must be a few more like them capable of running some of the nation's major firms. What if we combine this hopeful new open-mindedness with the corporate America version of the Rooney Rule? That's the NFL's mandate, requiring teams to interview at least one minority candidate for a head coaching vacancy. It doesn't mean forcing an unqualified person into a position. It simply encourages them to consider all qualified candidates. It's a way of coaxing owners beyond their insular and elite world. It widens the pool and gives those outside the traditional circles of power an opportunity to showcase their abilities. Think of it as an attempt to level the corporate playing field.
Television journalist Dwayne Ballen lives in Durham, North Carolina. If you want your opinions to get some playing time, head on over to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. To the Super Bowl for just a second. Here's the obligatory mention of the cost of a television commercial during the big game. It's about $2.6 million for 30 seconds this year. But what if an advertiser didn't have to worry about the network? What if they could do something bigger and better? Say an actual video ad right there on the field at Dolphin Stadium. How much you figure they'd pay for that? Alex Goldmark reports technology might give us the answer in just a few short years.
They call it turf TV because, well, it can turn football field turf into a television.
Not, you know, high definition, but it's comparable to a regular television screen. There's 1,160 pixels per square foot.
Mark Nichols is CEO of Sportex, the company that makes the field. They put fiber optic straws, as he calls them, inside each little strand of fake grass. But besides that, he says it's a normal turf field.
Plays the same, looks the same, is the same durability. The difference is shooting up through the middle of that straw is light. And when we can determine what and in what configuration those light up in, with the push of a button, it can look like a football field. And with a push of another button, it can be a soccer field.
And a Saturday Night Fever-style flashing floor for a halftime show even, which I personally wouldn't want to be standing on when it starts to rain.
Yeah, I think one of the common misconceptions is that you actually are going to get electrocuted by it. Fiber optics have nothing to do with electricity at all. It's a transfer of light. So there's no chance of anyone being electrocuted.
And fiber optics have some other potentially useful properties.
So as you walk down the field, I could essentially light your footprints behind you. When that receiver is catching the ball and sliding out of bounds, I can actually light exactly where they touch the ground.
Instant replay gets a makeover. But a field like that costs a pretty penny, as much as $1.5 million, about five times the cost of a conventional turf field. So owners who buy Turf TV will want it to pay for itself somehow. Maybe in the new Giants Stadium, say, to switch the end zone colors from Giants blue to Jets green without the cost of repainting or replanting turf each week. Or it could mean a whole new kind of in-stadium ad.
Well, from an advertising standpoint, the field is a computer screen. You can do anything on it you want.
If it's allowed. The NFL prohibits ads on playing surfaces, but they say they don't have a policy about fiber optic fields yet. College stadiums are a bit more lax. Allstate already paints their logo on the nets between goalposts used during a field goal kick.
So you see the net being raised, and all of a sudden there's a reveal to the Allstate logo with the hands. The kick is made, and everyone's focused on that net. And in many cases, you know, what we always like to see is the ball going right into the hands.
It was a good hands that time.
John Hagley is COO of Van Wagner Sports Group. They sell the ads for five to six figures per net, depending on the school. So if goalpost nets are making stadiums good money, then it's not hard to imagine the temptation of a field that can play video ads. Sports purists might worry this could take ads even farther than when Major League Baseball painted home plate to promote the Spider-Man 2 movie.
Yeah, there's definitely a fine line between being present and being annoying.
Adam Salicuse is an expert in going far, but not too far, with advertising. Ad agencies turn to his firm, Alt Terrain Media, for tasteful, unconventional exposure, like 3D moving billboards with live actors inside them.
We usually advise clients along lines saying this will be, you know, accepted or embraced by consumers, but if you do too much of it or if you do it in the wrong places, there will be issues.
And if the 50-yard line starts flashing a beer logo during every timeout, will consumers start throwing bottles instead of buying them? In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, some bad news for those living in U.S. coastal regions. The Army Corps of Engineers released a list today of 122 levees that are at risk of failing. That means they have one or more problems, including flood wall movement, erosion, and tree growth. There are suspect levees all over the country, including Kentucky and Rhode Island, but California and Washington State top the list, with 37 and 19 of them, respectively. The report highlights the possible danger to those living in nearby communities. Also means their insurance rates will probably go up. But on the brighter side, their paychecks might be getting bigger. The Senate passed a minimum wage increase late this afternoon. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 51 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 4 points, almost 0.2%. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, more than 0.5%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, the fashion industry takes a look in the mirror.
I don't want to sit and watch a runway show and wince and recoil because that model on the runway looks like she should be in the hospital bed.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.